folks. This is your captain speaking.
Technorama.
Remember when?
Technorama.
On this day in tech history.
Tech.
And now, the news.
Tech.
What the chuck?
Technorama.
Welcome to Blockhead Video.
Excuse me, sir. Where do you keep your fine vintage computers?
Over there, in the media corner.
Technorama.
Hold my beer and watch this.
Unfasten your seatbelts and disregard all safety rules. Here are your flight crew, Chuck and Craig.
Welcome to Technorama, the show that takes a lighthearted look at tech, science, sci-fi, and all things geek. I am your host, Chuck Tomasi, and with me is Craig Stepp, bringing you another special. We're very excited to bring you part one in our series from the Computer History Museum in Mountain View, California. While a number of museums devoted to computers already exist, both in traditional form and online repositories, the Computer History Museum eclipses its precursors in the depth and volume of its collection, as well as the prominence and dedication of its supporters. The Computer History Museum grew out of a home collection started by computing pioneer Gordon Bell and his wife Gwen. In 1979, the Bells installed a number of significant pieces in the lobby of a former RCA building that Digital Equipment Corporation had purchased. Gordon Bell worked for 23 years at DEC, where he led the development of the PDP series and VAX computers. By 1983, after a couple of moves, the growing collection ended up on Boston's Museum Wharf, where it shared space with the Children's Museum. As the Computer Museum, its focus shifted to serving a young constituency while continuing to collect key artifacts for later display. In 2000, the Computer History Museum collection moved to temporary quarters on the NASA base at Moffett Federal Airfield in Sunnyvale, California, where it occupied a pair of pre-World War II buildings. Soon, museum trustees began searching for a more suitable location. When the Computer History Museum acquired its current building in 2002, the former Silicon Graphics Marketing and Sales Office offered enough space for a 400-seat auditorium and still contained more than 450 office cubicles, though many have since been incorporated into exhibit installations. We've arrived at the Computer History Museum, and our docent is Stan Seeler. How are you today, Stan?
Fine, thank you.
Stan is agreed to show us around at some of the wonderful things. We are really looking forward to this. Just glancing around, there's all kinds of things that have me going gaga like a little boy.
Yeah, you need something to wipe your mouth with?
I think we do have napkins available. So where have you started us off, Stan?
We're in a walkthrough exhibit called Innovation in the Valley, which is dedicated to the technical history of Silicon Valley.
Excellent. And you're explaining that the technical history of the Silicon Valley is much longer than most people would think. I mean, when I think of it, I think of, the 70s and Apple computers starting up and maybe Honeywell and HP prior to that. So I could probably push it back to 60s or even 50s, but how far do we really go back in this area?
Well, your 50s and 60s is a good point. That's Fairchild, for example, started around that time, and that's what people think of for the transistor era. But the innovation here started much earlier, around the turn of the earlier century, in the early 1900s, with Philo T. Farnsworth, with the founder of the KCBS radio station. The first commercial radio station in the world was in San Jose, so we've had a very early history.
Still, would any computer museum really be worthy of the title without holding a copy of what is arguably among the most significant machines in Silicon Valley? Installed in a vintage hand-built plywood case, the 1975 Apple I enshrined at the Computer History Museum bears the Woz autograph of Apple co-founder Steve Wozniak. Apple I's, of which fewer than 50 still exist, are avidly sought by collectors. And what are we standing in front of here? Help the listener.
Yeah, an Apple I. This is a functional Apple I that was donated to the museum. When the Apple I was originally released, it was a kit, which cost $666.66. And I'll say it again, they had a 6 cents anywhere. You can always edit that out.
No. That stays in.
This is a fairly clean design. It's a rectangular printed circuit board. And you can see they've labeled everything, not just reference designators for the RAM W1, W2, W3. It says 6502 microprocessor on it. You can see the power supply is not discrete. It's embedded into the circuit board. But yet there's some kind of, I don't know, Tesla coil off to the side for converting the power down to the necessary voltage. The keyboard is off to the side. It's mounted to a piece of plywood. So we'll have pictures and, of course, links to that on Flickr. But it's an interesting piece of work.
You're also... There, we have another one in our main exhibit area, which has been signed by Steve Wozniak. But if you're really interested in this, several people now sell replicas of Apple Ones that you can assemble yourself.
Oh, really? For the same $666?
It's a little bit more, but not much more. Really? You can either get it as a kit or fully assembled. And
$667 now.
At least one of them has Steve Wozniak's blessing and includes the original firmware that came with it.
There are some kludges on here. I do see resistors and things sticking up above the main printed circuit board that leading me to believe there were some oopses that needed fixing.
Not uncommon in early computers, even mainframes from big companies. You'd see mostly everything was machine wire wrapped, but occasionally you'd see a hand-installed wire to solve a problem.
Oh, I've seen some of those.
Yeah.
Even like little parallel cards I used to install. Yeah. You know, somebody...
Little yellow wire running along.
It's a bug fix.
Yep. How about his blue box?
This is the blue box.
A blue box.
We've heard about this. This is the story of Wozniak and his blue box to do the phone freaking, to get the tapping. And the story goes he was stopped by a police officer, and he said, "What is this?" And Woz said... "It's a synthesizer for music," because music synthesizers were just coming out about that time. And the officer said, "You're too late. A guy named Moog beat you to it." But they got away with it, because if they'd known what it was, for real, they would have been in big trouble. And next to that we have...
an Apple Macintosh original model.
Wow.
The 128K. It doesn't even say Macintosh on the front. Now, the rumor is... that this is signed inside the case by the original founders.
Okay. That I don't know, sorry.
Well,
and it's
let's break it out.
No, we can't. Yeah, we're not going to open that up today.
Yes. We'd have a number of archivists annoyed at us if we did that.
I'm sure.
For the things I'm allowed to touch, I have to wear a glove to touch them.
Ah.
And you will see some in the visible storage.
Excellent. So, Speaking of storage. What do we have?
IBM 1311, an early removable disk drive. Similar to, I think, is it iOmega Jazz, removable drives. This was from circa 1963. Says it's the first 14-inch disk drive with a removable disk pack.
Portable, even.
Portable. This was an important thing for a lot of data centers. When I was in school, we had one of a spare disk pack that students used for our programming, and at night we'd take the main disk packs out and put our disk packs in, and then use the system without having to worry about corrupting other people's data or stealing it.
Now, this was a big thing, because prior to this, what did they use?
Well, we had disk drives prior to this, but not much earlier than that. And earlier drives tended to be a little bit larger, as you can see.
A little. This thing is about 3 feet in diameter. Mm-hmm. My goodness, just think of the flywheel action on that thing.
And look at the micro drive embedded in the middle.
Oh, that's neat. In the middle of the 6-inch hub, there's a little micro drive, sure enough.
The Computer History Museum had not seen these drives before until they got the Iliac 4, and it came with a bunch of these drives. So every time you see one of these drives in the museum, it'll say Iliac 4. They didn't realize that all Burroughs mainframes had those drives with them.
Wow.
Because I used them in 1970 on my Burroughs 6700 at school.
I've got some 16-inch platters, or 14-inch platters, that I've turned into clocks. When we decommissioned our PDP-11 at work, I grabbed a few of those, and I had to destroy the plastic enclosure to get them, unfortunately. But one is hanging in our office, and I've got two at home. They make lovely clocks.
If the PDP-11 was one of the... Oh, sorry, it's an 11. Did it have lights and switches?
No, not quite that old. It was 11750.
Then it's not all that collectible. So.
No, unfortunately not. We did keep a nice picture of it in the computer data center as a memento. It's about all that lives on.
I have some neighbors that I still don't talk to. When they first moved in, they found out I was interested in old computers, and they said, "Oh, we have a PDP-8 at work, and there's a raffle going on to see who gets to destroy it."
No. That's like destroying, you know, a 69 Camaro.
Did you buy like 15,000 tickets?
If I'd thought of it, I would have bought tickets. But this is a photograph of the world's first disk drive created here in San Jose by IBM. And we have one on display that we're actually trying to remodel and get working again. Its platters were about this size, and there were about 20 of them, and it had a single disk head, so the arm had to move out, up, and then back in.
One head moved between 20 platters.
Yes, so the next model had one head per platter,
okay,
which is what almost every disk drive in the world has now, is one head per platter, except for this the Burroughs. This was a head per track drive, so it was fantastically expensive, but there were no moving heads in it. There was hundreds of heads, so very, very, very fast, but also very expensive.
Now, older hard drives like this were extremely sensitive to vibration, calibration,
power fluctuations.
You know, I can drop that micro drive and it'll still keep working.
Yes.
I've dropped my iPod a number of times and it continues to function.
Not me.
These things, you could sneeze and crash the hard drive.
Yes. When we get to visible storage, you'll see some actual crashes on a drum memory, which precedes these things, but you'll see the scratches on the surface.
Nice.
And the problem with removable disks is, let's say the head crashes against the drive. A very common problem, particularly with inattentive operators, is they say, oh, it's not working. And they would take the pack out, put it in another drive. But if the head's crashed, there's a furrow that's been raised on the surface. Yep. You then take that pack, put it in a good drive, the head comes along and hits the furrow and ruins the head. One of my coworkers ruined three disk drives that way. The maintenance guy paid for the first one and split the cost on the second one, but the third one we had to pay for because it was operator error.
You have to admit, though, it's a fairly simplistic design on this 1311.
Oh, yes.
There's a green button, a start-stop button, and a drawer to put the disk pack in.
Very early ones, I'm not sure about IBM because I heard this about a different manufacturer, didn't really have high-quality air filters. And when you turn it off, when you turn it back on again, there was dust and particulate matter which was whirling around. Mm-hmm. So one guy was saying, after a power failure, they would turn it on and they would go home and come back the next day. And by that time, the filters had taken out most of the junk so that you could use the drive reliably, which is pretty strange. Hewlett-Packard had a drive like this that when you turn it on, it sucked the air out and it said purge on the little 6 or 8 character display. Unfortunately, it also thumped like a washing machine. So there were a couple of operators who nearly had heart attacks when they turn on their disk drive and it says purge and it starts shaking like it's falling apart. So they quickly made a firmware change to say air purge instead of purge.
Extracting data?
Right.
Now, I'm looking at the label on the hub of this disk pack and it says Fortran 4, September 28th, 1976. Hey, how timely.
Yeah.
Just to give the listener a sense of relative capacity, this was in 1963. The capacity of 6 platters in here was 2.68 megabytes, which was a lot. There were 50 tracks per inch and 1,025 bits per inch, which is just over 1K. And the transfer rate was 0.068 megabytes per second.
It's blazing.
Which was blazing when you compared it to, you know, say, tape, for example.
Mm-hmm.
This was a fast storage and held a lot for its time. I programmed in Fortran 4.
Same here, yes.
That's what those punch cards
I still do occasionally. One of my clients programs only in Fortran. It's a strange world.
Yeah. Good scientific language. It was fast.
Hi, this is Grant Imahara from Mythbusters, and Myth Confirmed, you're listening to Chuck and Craig on Technorama.
Around the world, everyone's opening the bathroom doors to expose the...
Wash your hands before every email.
Yeah, Chuck Tomasi's the devil. I like it, okay. It just feels tacked on. Have you used it, Chuck?
I'm weird, sorry.
Go.
Craig, I heard that. You were taking a drink and almost lost it. I'm going to get you sooner or later. We're going to hear all over the microphone.
You're right.
Chuck, you owe me a new microphone. Did I ask for this?
Sort of a hodgepodge here, ranging from an early audio oscillator from Hewlett-Packard, which was their first product. Walt Disney Company helped put them into business because Disney bought a number of them to use in the creation of Fantasia. Mm-hmm. And I don't know why those lights aren't. Oh, really, that turned out. Great. Coupled with Hewlett-Packard's first small handheld calculator, the HP 35. It's a great calculator.
They didn't really change that basic design too much, did they?
No, not for a long time.
It's the same rectangular keys, same dark brown case. This one has a red, seven-segment LCD or LED display on it. Those things ate up batteries fast.
One of my friends, I'm an amateur magician, and one of my friends is also a magician, but he used to work at HP, and he said that he was involved in assembling the first ever HP 35s. They were trying to get enough assembled so they would have one per board member for the board meeting so that they could say, here it is, we finished it. So they spent about a day and a half trying to find enough good chips to manufacture about eight or however many board member things there were. So they had them up for the board member. One more member, and he won't tell me who it was, spent the meeting typing in numbers until he got something where he could hold it upside down and show a slightly racy word. And that was his interest in it.
Was that the 4377734?
No, I think it's B00.
Yeah, that's what I was saying.
Oh, okay. Wow. Even racier than I thought.
80035. There you go.
That's bad. This is a reproduction of Doug Engelbart's first mouse, the wooden box. I don't believe it's the original first mouse.
No, but it does look like that. I've seen it on YouTube. There was a video, I think.
It's dented up enough. It could be.
And so, you know, I don't know if this... Well, we had a reproduction here, but this looks like it's the real one. Oh, and that's a newer tag, so it probably is the real one.
Now, the interesting thing to note is the buttons are not on the mouse.
Oh, I'm sorry, that's a separate device.
Right. It's an early commercial mouse.
So he's got one button. How Apple-like.
Right.
Yeah.
And it took one of our engineers where I work to explain exactly how the mouse works. Because I thought it was... I knew it had a slotted wheel in there. Mm-hmm. And I thought it was just a send and receive transmitter. And I said, how do you know when you stop... if the next on-off signal means you're moving forward or backward on that wheel?
Hey, how do you?
He looked at me and he said, quadrature waveform output. And I said, that's nice, Fred. Can you explain that to me, please? And he said, there are actually two sets, a pair of transmitters and a pair of receivers, and one is 90 degrees offset. So one is sort of half looking through a hole and half not. So you've got four possible states. On, off, off, on, off, okay. Off. And depending on what the next state is, now you know whether you're moving forward or backward.
Got it.
And one is in the X and one is in the Y.
Right. More than a 0-1. Okay.
So, of course, I took apart the next mechanical mouse that died and looked at it and went, sure enough, Fred was right.
Cool. Thank you. That's one of the nice things about giving tours here is you always learn something on every tour from somebody, whether it's just a new question you haven't heard before or new information. So thanks.
Sure.
Stan, we're just glad we didn't have, you know, some 18-year-old boy walking around here going...
I told Chuck earlier, I said, if we get somebody younger than us...
The first time I came into the museum and saw machines I'd worked on, I felt old.
So. Yeah.
This is kind of is interesting. It's a Busicom calculator, but this calculator had the Intel 4004 chip in it. This is
really?
The calculator, the company that commissioned the chip from Intel, and they used it in the
It's as a calculator. Very much styled after an adding machine.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it looks like an adding machine, but yet there is a primitive printed circuit board, probably two-sided, one of those sort of translucent gray ones. With chips and sockets on. It was amazing how many of the old things were socketed, wasn't it?
I can actually give you one comment on that. In circa 1984, 85, I was talking with the manufacturer of memory boards for PCs and for mainframes, and I asked why he wasn't socketing his memory chips when most people were, and he says, oh, the chips have a certain failure rate, and the sockets have about the same failure rate. So when you socket them, you double the failure rate, and he didn't want to do that. Because he's offering a lifetime warranty in his boards.
There's got to be a cost factor also.
Yes.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Definitely. Now, I've got some computers where I sure wish some of the chips were socketed, because one of them has a Dallas Semiconductor real-time clock chip where the battery died 5 years ago. It's an internal battery, and the chip's soldered onto the board, so I can't get it out. So it has no real-time clock anymore. But a little history of some of the early pioneers in terms of microprocessors: Ted Hoff, Federico Fagan from Intel, and Stan Mazur at Fairchild. This is a fun one.
A Pentium 4. I got a Pentium 60, original Pentium at home.
Ah,
the one you can cook eggs on.
What do we have here, Stan?
This, you've heard of the ads from Sun being the .com. Well, this is the start of Sun. It's a Sun 1 workstation. Sun stands for Stanford University Networking,
yes,
which is where they started. And this is one of the actual first models of Sun.
How about that? It looks like a basic data terminal. I mean, it's got that 3278, heavy keyboard.
IBM background.
Yeah.
Sorry.
I'm a giveaway.
Yeah, it does. It does look quite a lot like it. A little cleaner looking in some respects.
You're right.
IBM look, but
there were too many keys.
This is from 1982, so it's 25. It was probably their 25th anniversary. Never thought of it. But,
I wonder if they had any any celebration?
That's a good question.
And then in here we've got a little device. What is this?
It's a prototype of a PDA that they didn't actually market.
It looks like an industrial GPS or something.
It does.
It's about that size.
Or something a supermarket clerk carries around doing inventory on.
Sure.
The Green Project Term Team.
The Java programming language allowed software to be written once and run anywhere, i.e. on PC, Macintosh, and Unix. Nice pipe dream. Greatly simplified the task of writing software on different hardware platforms. James Gosling led a team of Sun product engineers in the development effort that became known as the Green Project. The team included Bill Joy, Richard Koch, Timothy Lindholm, John Payne, Arthur Van Hoff, and Frank Yellen.
My wife says it's write once, test everywhere.
Yeah. That's about right.
Display of some early Cisco equipment.
Yes, this looks very much like what one of our listeners sent us from CERN over in Switzerland. He's from Belgium, but he was on vacation. He said, "I have a picture of one of the first Cisco routers, and by gosh, if this doesn't look very similar to a picture he said does."
Invisible storage will show you something which is arguably the first router for the internet back when there were only three computers on the net, and it's the size of a telephone booth. So this, which is about twice the volume of a standard desktop PC, is much, much smaller already.
What is it, about 6 rack units? 5 or 6?
Probably.
The early Cisco router, based on a slightly modified Sun 1 circuit board. I didn't know that.
I didn't know that either.
Was used to interconnect networks, allowing people to access or transfer information without regard to difference in time, place, type of computer system, or networking protocol. The museum also boasts such seminal creations as a World War II German Enigma encryption device, an 1889 Hollerith electromechanical census tabulator, punch cards from Jacquard textile looms, an Altair 8800 microcomputer, a portion of the ENIAC, and the hulking, jettison-esque JohnniAC machine, named after famed mathematician John von Neumann, who is said to have disapproved of the honor. A curiosity that is especially beloved by museum visitors is a display of Honeywell animals. Works of naturalistic art created from thousands of transistors, resistors, and bits of wire. Besides the Enigma, the Computer History Museum is home to the largest remaining fragment of the Colossus machines that first decrypted and coded messages from Germany's high command. The famed Norden bombsight of World War II was a mechanical analog computer made from gyroscopes, motors, gears, mirrors, levers, and a telescope. During a bombing run, it could simultaneously pilot an aircraft and determine when to release its payload. The invention proved critical to the success of Allied high-altitude daylight bombing. Though the technology behind the Norden bombsight was a closely guarded secret for decades after the war, a surprising number of the devices survive and appear regularly in aviation restoration parts catalogs. Still, the Computer History Museum has one on display to highlight the role of analog computing technology in warfare.
Now, let me ask you a question. Or how do you get your stuff from donations? Or
a lot of it is donations. Some of it is acquisitions, but it's mostly donations.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just trying to think. If you go to our website, www.computerhistory.org, there somewhere on there is a donations link, and we talk about what we do need, what we don't need. We don't really need more people to bring IBM PCs or Macintoshes,
sure.
Unless it's serial number 1 or 2 yeah. or 3 or something like that. And occasionally we'll make exceptions. I saw on our webpage that we didn't want any more PDP 5, 6, 7s, 8s. Mm-hmm. But when we saw pristine condition PDP 5, we broke the rule and we went after it. So for outstanding examples, I think the museum is interested. One of the problems we have is storage, and it's sort of full, although I think we're acquiring some more storage right now. And we'll fill that up too.
Now, do y'all do restoration of some of these things, or how does that work? Or do people, do you just put it up there and the condition it is?
Very good question. We have restored 3 mainframes. An IBM 1620 was our first restoration project. It took a couple of years, and there were a number of volunteers. They took it entirely apart, labeling everything, cleaning the contacts. We found that some of the core memory had corroded. We went down to Fry's to buy some, but they were all out of core.
Yeah.
So we had to build semiconductor memory that looked like core in that case. But the rest of the machine we were able to use as it was. We put it back together and got it working. And right about that time, the teleprinter died, so we now have a PC that looks like a teleprinter, and occasionally we'll run the machine. We have a problem with it right now. The cooling fan has a burned out bearing. The second and third restorations were in PDP-1 from DEC and IBM 1401. Those machines were like 2 or 3 years apart maybe in the marketplace, but the people restoring them are volunteers. They're like 10, 12 years apart,
mm-hmm.
because the IBM 1401, old engineers who were professionals are working on restoring it. The PDP-1, students who use the PDP-1 when it was new are restoring it. So there's a gap in ages, which is just kind of interesting to watch.
That is interesting.
Some of the people restoring our PDP-1 were involved in writing Space War, the world's first computer video game,
mm-hmm.
So which we run here twice a month. On the first and third Saturdays of the month, we run Space War on Saturday. You can play Space War against one of the original authors and lose.
No kidding.
Yeah.
Wow.
I've lost to him, and I was very good at Space War, so... So I was surprised. So I hope that answers your question. Most of the big equipment is not runnable, but those 3 things we've restored.
Yeah, I was wondering if donations, if they actually have to function,
no.
Or you just...
No requirement for functioning.
Okay.
So
now this type of setup that we're in front of looks familiar. I work for an electronics design firm. Oftentimes, before you get a smaller device, they'll have a prototype mock-up, which is, you know, it's got standoffs, it's a bigger breadboard section for doing some outside prototyping. Tell us what we're looking at here.
This is one of the prototypes for the Palm Pilot. And you can see that the display is the actual display that they used in the real Palm, including the little graffiti area at the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And there's about 8 or 10 blue wires coming from it to a small circuit board, about a square foot. And that board has the electronics that actually implements the Palm. So by doing this, they were able to test the user interface and the graffiti aspect of it while still making changes to the underlying implementation.
There's several sockets on what looks like a daughter board plugged in. I assume that's some sort of emulator that they can change the firmware. There seems to be at least 3 discrete pieces here. There's the display, there's a logic board, which has, you know, your power inputs, and there's connectors all over the place,
right.
Which...
Well, how about the chip soldered on top of a chip?
That's hot glued to the daughter board.
To the daughter board.
That's a lovely piece.
Nice technique, by the way.
As long as they don't ship it that way.
Right. How are we going to get that in the enclosure, boys?
I know that this technique has been used at least since 1979 because I saw HP testing out the 16C calculator in the same manner. They had the display,
mm-hmm.
And then they had a bunch of wires going to a box which had the guts in it.
And then off to the side, you'll often have a development system, I mean, a whole separate computer system,
yeah.
That you'll be writing the assembly code and compiling it, and then you download it. And this would be a processor emulator. So there's actually no Palm processor in this configuration. It's all emulated, and then you can do branch testing and tracing and lots of different stuff. So it's kind of neat to see this in something I've held in my own very own hands.
Well, there's this a cell phone now called the OpenMoco. And you can buy this a development kit, and it's much like this, where you can break it out and you can write code to it through the computer. So it's just what you're talking about. You have the computer, your computer on one side, talk to the device on the other, and program it and whatnot.
Interesting thing about the Palm is it was very revolutionary in the way that it was implemented. Nobody ever thought of holding a device and writing on it.
Mm-hmm.
And
Until
then, you always had a keyboard.
Wait a minute.
Well, next door to the Palm, we have its cousin.
The Newton.
This is a Newton, I believe, yes.
Mm-hmm. The original iPhone.
And even the Newton had, there were predecessors to that, including some machines from Japan, where you could actually, in some manner, write on the screen. I have one where you can draw little calculator-type symbols, including square roots, and it figures them out. It doesn't do text, but does digits and numeric things.
Yeah, and I'm writing square roots all the time.
Yeah, me too. and completely strangely placed chronologically, we have a klystron.
Is a klystron?
It's used in microwaves, and that's about all I know.
It looks like a small engine.
It does. With a magnet. I guess that's the magnetron.
A klystron played an important part in the development of microwave technology, made commercial air navigation safer, opening the possibility of worldwide communication by satellite, and led to a variety of high-energy particle accelerators used in medicine and nuclear physics. Interesting.
It generates microwave radiation.
Okay.
You can use it to send microwaves out like a radar, or to, which I think is the way it was originally used.
Thanks for listening to Technorama. If you have any comments or feedback about this or other episodes, in the U.S., give us a call on the listener line at 206-222-2428. An easy way to remember that is 206-222-CHAT. If you're outside the U.S., we recommend using Skype for free computer-to-computer calls. Just download Skype from skype.com and add Chuck Chat to your buddy list. You can also send us an email at technorama@chuckchat.com. We'd love to hear from you. Technorama can be found at chuckchat.com, where you can find out more about our regular show and how to get it automatically delivered to you. This show is a proud member of Friends in Tech. You can find out more at friendsintech.com. We're also affiliated with Farpoint Media and all the great shows there. Visit them at farpointmedia.net for a great collection of audio content. Thanks for listening. Share Technorama with a friend. And until next time, and this seems more appropriate than ever for the Computer History Museum, a binary high five.
101.